Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Angeli. This hour on the program, this upcoming Memorial Day weekend features the annual powwow sponsored by the Native American Indian Center of Central Ohio. The theme of the powwow this year is We Are All Related. We're going to find out more about Native American Indian culture and issues of interest and concern to the Ohio Indian community. My guests are representatives of the Central Ohio American Indian community. Mark Welch, program director, back with us. Of NACO, that's the acronym for the Native American Indian Center of Central Ohio. Mark, welcome back.
Good morning, Fred.
Joining us also in the studio, Ashley Hilliard is Student Interim Coordinator of the Ohio State University American Indian Student Services. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to hear.
And later in the program, at the half-hour mark, joining us from Cleveland, Chris Begay is Chairman of the Committee for 500 Years of Dignity and Resistance. We'll be talking to Chris. We're at 614-292-8513, and you can email your questions or comments to openline@wosu.org. Mark, you were quoted as saying, attending a powwow is a way to dispel common misconceptions and negative images that separate people from each other. Could you tell us a little more about that?
I think so, because most people, they get their basic knowledge from Hollywood movies.
And most about American Indians.
Yeah, about American Indians.
Yeah.
And almost all of the things you see in the Hollywood movies are not true.
Such as?
For example,
not true.
It is not true.
That was the war cry, I guess, in the Hollywood movies.
The war cries. And what had happened in the late 1800s, around 1890, when they started making movies, it occurred to Hollywood directors that they could make a lot of money making cowboys and Indian movies.
Sure. But they got a villain they constructed. Right?
They had a villain. Yeah. It never occurred to them to go to the reservations or talk to Native people about the cultures. Mm-hmm. And so they made up their own cultures. And it got so permeated in the mainstream culture that they started teaching that as fact in the public school systems.
Even in the textbooks.
Even in the textbooks. Mm-hmm. And so you go to the powwows, and you get to see that, that it's not wild gyrations around the bonfire.
Yeah.
And for some people, it's just it's entertainment. But there's some people, non-Native and Native both, who go and all of a sudden they begin to see that there's meaning in each step. Mm. There's meaning in the regalia that's being worn. Mm-hmm. There's meaning in each word that's being said. And all of a sudden the blinders are taken off.
Uh-huh.
And they begin to realize that Native people are human beings too.
Sure. Ashley, you were nodding your head in agreement as Mark was speaking.
Yeah, it's difficult because a lot of people are not aware of Native culture, and they get their misconceptions from popular culture and visual media. Mm-hmm. And so what we have to combat is these long-rooted stereotypes. And through the powwow, it's an amazing experience, and it's amazing to see people who have come and have completely changed their worldviews.
You see this happen.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
We used to host a student powwow hosted by the American Indian Council here at OSU, and we would have people come in that were required to go there for a class or mm-hmm. that they had just stopped in to see what was going on. And, you know, their remarks were, you know, I never knew this is what Native culture was. I never knew that, you know, it was more of a spiritual kind of thing. I just thought it was what it was in the movies. And so it's a long struggle.
So the stereotypes really persist, you're saying, even in
yes.
young people. I mean, they're still there.
I know that when I was in school, it was difficult. I was the only Native student in my high school and in my entire schooling career.
Where was this?
East Liverpool. It's
okay.
A little town on the Ohio River. And
yeah.
So it was difficult because a lot of what I was reading, I knew was wrong. And
right in the textbook. You
right
saw
in the textbook.
You,
I saw it. Yeah. I knew it was wrong. And I had to raise my hand and be that girl
said,
but that doesn't sound right.
When you did that and you raised your hand, I mean, were teachers respectful of that? Did they?
A lot of the teachers are respectful. I think that they realize that a lot of the information put into textbooks is inaccurate at times mm-hmm. and that they have to accept this and hopefully teach a little differently and learn from their
lessons. Yeah, do you remember some of the things that the textbooks, I haven't looked at a high school textbook in a long time, some of the things they said that were just totally out of line?
A lot of it was just that there would be one little paragraph at mm-hmm. the end of a chapter. Mm-hmm. Oh, there were these Indians and they were in our way, but we moved them out.
Yeah.
Or we got rid of them. And it was really kind of hard for me as a student to see that because I knew my people aren't dead. My people are still here. Mm-hmm. We're still alive. We're flourishing. Yeah. The government took us down a couple notches at points, but we're here.
But in the textbooks, you were sort of an afterthought. Yeah, a paragraph here and there.
Yeah.
Same thing that's happened to African Americans and to some extent women, I think.
Well, I think also in those textbooks and also in the movies, they usually portray Native Americans as savages
yeah.
or primitive. Let's just talk about the mounds here in the Central Ohio
yes,
area.
Yes, okay, sure.
You look at those mounds and those built by the ancestors, they had to know geometry. They had to know astronomy, you know, just pi alone, making those circles accurately, mm-hmm. you know. And the effigies, that how they build them, and you can't even see them from the ground, or how they're being built. There's nothing primitive about our people.
We're thinking, I think when you say that, Mark, I think of the Newark earthworks, you yeah. know, and the fact that scholars feel that they were built in such a way as to line up with the moon rise at a certain point, and that was, they're not sure, it might have been a religious ceremony, it might have been astronomical, but in order to line them up this way, yeah. They had to undergo some pretty complex calculations.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also there were roads built, I believe, from a town to town by the ancient cultures that, again, in order to build a road that actually goes somewhere and works, you have to understand geometry and a lot of other things as well.
This is true. And I think that a lot of times that's overlooked.
Yeah.
And another thing is overlooked quite a bit is quite a few of the medicines that are still used to this day originated with Native Americans. And, you know, so a lot of times we're the forgotten minority.
Mm-hmm.
Another statistic which will come into play this weekend, our powwows this weekend, is not only are we remembering our people like Selma and a lot of our other people, but we're also taking time to honor our veterans. And, you know, the Native American population is less than 1% of the total population, but we make up 14% of the armed forces.
No kidding.
So that's quite a stat.
You know, I want to, first of all, say that the powwow is at the Franklin County Fairgrounds Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, and everybody's welcome, right?
That's correct.
The whole community. Right?
The whole community. And we're hoping that you come down. And like I said, there'll be some people, they'll just sit around and watch the dancing. But this is an opportunity to experience some of the Native American cultures.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually come out into the dance circle and talk to our people and mm-hmm. begin to get an understanding. And one of the best things that is true, I think, with all Native people, especially the traditional people, is always making a relationship, trying to make a relationship not only with ourselves but with each other and with other people and with all God's creation. And when you begin to realize that the powwow is a celebration of life and it's an opportunity to come and be a part of that, then there's a better understanding of our different cultures.
I want to take a moment here to remember Selma Walker. What a wonderful person. She founded the Native American Indian Center, right, many years ago. And
she's just a
stalwart in our community. And tell us a little more about Selma, to whom the powwow was dedicated this year.
And one of the things I found out about Selma, she's my mother-in-law.
Yeah.
And in my tradition, you don't use the name of your mother-in-law without your grandmother pulling on your ears. But in this case, we got to make an exception. As I travel all across Turtle Island here, or what we know as the United States.
You call it Turtle Island?
Turtle Island.
Okay.
And because of our traditions that the turtle, they placed the dirt on the back of the turtle, and it began to grow. And so we're literally on the back of the turtle, so we're on Turtle Island.
Mm-hmm.
And as I travel to the different areas, South Dakota, where we're from, or Oklahoma, or even California, there are people that knew Selma, were impacted by Selma. Now, on paper, the Native American Indian Center of Central Ohio was founded in 1975. But long before then, she was actually using the trunk of her car, taking food and clothing mm-hmm. to Native people. Found out that a lot of our people were living on the streets, down the riverbank, so she made sure that they were taken care of. And she helped a lot of our people get jobs. And so she founded the original center in 1975. And, you know, they didn't have enough money to rent the building. So Selma and the people it was involved in, they actually went out during rainstorms and collected earthworms and sold the earthworms to bait stores. Hmm. And that's how they raised the money to open the first center.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
So, you know, a lot of people said it couldn't be done. And Selma was one of those people that once she made up her mind, she found a way for it to be done.
How many Native American Indian people are there in Central Ohio? Do we have good numbers on that? Do we know?
Well, it depends on who you talk to and who you listen to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's quite a few other people that aren't identified as Native Americans, because for the longest time, the government and other officials would come, literally steal the babies out of arms of their mothers and their fathers, take them to boarding schools.
They took them away.
Oh, yeah, took
them
away.
And why? You mean, we're talking about now what time frame here?
This is from the middle of 1800s, mm-hmm. clear into the middle of the 1900s.
Yeah.
And actually, some of the boarding schools still exist. They're not as bad as they used to be.
Now, they took the babies away from the parents.
Yeah.
Because why? They felt that. Why?
Well, the purpose of the government was either assimilate or exterminate.
Hmm.
And so they was trying to assimilate Native American children into the general population.
Mm-hmm.
And they were forbidden to speak their native language. They were forbidden to follow their spiritual way of life, forbidden to wear their traditional clothing. And they were supposed to become white except in skin color.
Hmm. And in the government schools, sponsored by the federal government, they weren't allowed to use their language, right? Their language was discouraged.
In fact, they were highly punished
mm-hmm.
if they did that. So quite a few of our people, to avoid sending their children through that, would not enroll their children on the tribes.
Yeah.
So we got quite a few people. They know they're Native American. You can look at them and know for a fact they're Native American, but they can't prove that they're Native American.
Yeah.
So we got that. What was the question?
Well, the question was about how many do we have good numbers on how many?
Oh yeah.
In Central Ohio.
So just going by what we're told by the people themselves, we got about 13,000 here in the Central Ohio area,
mm-hmm.
and in the state of Ohio, there's 33,000. Now, what amazing thing about that is that there's no reservations at all in the state.
Yeah.
No tribes. And when you consider that there's only 4.2 million people, Native people in the entire United States, 33,000 of them living in Ohio is all of a sudden a big number.
You know, it's interesting. I come from Western New York, and we have the Seneca Reservation, you know, and we have Iroquois as well, and I'm used to you know, those independent entities, you know, being there, but there are no reservations here in Ohio. How come?
Well, you know, they forcibly removed our mm-hmm. people in the 1800s. Last being before stop was the Wyandotte, and quite a few of the people stayed in the area, but they, you know, no longer had a reservation. They were no longer with their people.
So were they initially sent to reservations as white settlers moved west in
yes.
Ashley, and then
Ohio was a hotbed for refugees of many different tribes coming over from eastern U.S. to try to escape the white settlers. And Ohio was a place where they felt that they could stay, and initially it was until land was being gobbled up more and more, and with the Northwest Territory being opened, it opened up a whole host of new problems for the Native tribes in the area. And that's when you started seeing things like Pontiac's Rebellion and Tecumseh and Tenskwatawa. And these kind of things showed that they knew they had to fight or they were going to lose their land.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, all the fighting they wanted to do couldn't help the fact that all these settlers were coming in and pushing them out. So,
mm-hmm. I'm curious. I wonder why they were not pushed out from, let's say, Western New York, you know, where the reservations still exist, but yet they were in Ohio, and I don't know the difference there. But
it was because that was where the French were, and the British.
And they were allies.
The Americans were the ones pushing the natives out of Ohio area, and initially, treaties and alliances were tried to be made between the British and French and the native tribes, but the Americans knew that
mm-hmm.
these treaties and these kind of deals were being made, and they tried to put a stop to it as soon as they could.
So, Ashley, how many Native American Indian students here at The Ohio State University?
We have approximately 250 Native students that have self-identified with the university.
Okay, and of course, we want to mention Ashley Hilliard, one of our guests here, is the interim coordinator of the Ohio State University American Indian Student Services. What kind of services do you find that Native American Indian students need here? What do they come to see you about?
A lot of times they want to know if we're doing programming like powwows or any other kind of cultural events. And in that case, I get to refer them to NACO and their wonderful
Native
powwows.
Native American Indian Center, yeah.
Yes. And we used to do a powwow on campus, but our numbers have kind of dwindled as far as participation goes. So our powwow was not able to be put on the past couple of years. But hopefully in the next couple of years, we can get that up again.
That would be wonderful.
Because it was one of the more popular powwows because we had it toward the beginning of powwow season. So it was a nice way for people to start getting back into the powwow circuit and see old friends and just experience everything again. And it was really good for the students to come, especially non-Native students, because they were able to learn about Native culture in a more hands-on environment instead of just a textbook.
Any difficulties for American Indian students fitting into the majority culture on campus? Is that are there cultural differences that make it a little difficult, or is it pretty smooth?
As far as more traditional students, I would imagine that they would have a harder time. A lot of students that are self-identified as Native are more mainstreamed into society, and a lot of them grew up in predominantly white areas. Mm-hmm. So they're experiences are a little different.
So we would say they're assimilated, in other words.
Yes, yeah, yes. I mean, many have been completely assimilated into society, but they do know that they're Native, and a lot of...
That would be you as one, right?
Yes.
Yeah, sure, okay.
But a lot of students, like myself, I know that once I came to Ohio State, it was kind of a cultural awakening, and I was able to experience my culture in a way that I had never known, and... I actually helped produce a powwow, and that was the first powwow I had ever attended. And so these kind of things stay with you for the rest of your life.
Surely. Ashley, when you say you were able to experience your culture in a way that you had never known, what were some of the things you could tell us that you experienced?
As far as in college, I threw myself into it completely and became completely involved with the American Indian Council. And I learned about different kinds of ceremonies, and I learned about different kinds of treaties and events that I had never known about. As a history student, I was shocked and appalled that I had never heard of these things before coming to college. And in one of my first Native American history classes, as we were talking about different events like the Alcatraz takeover and the BIA takeover, I was mad because I had never known. And I was very upset that my education in high school didn't teach me these things. Instead, we spent the entire high school talking about the Civil War and about all these other things with things that didn't matter to me at that point, because all that mattered was that I was finding out something about my culture, and I was finding out about these events that had happened that were key to the formation of Native American identity.
You know, tell me about the Alcatraz. Alcatraz is the prison on the island off the coast of San Francisco. You can tourist right out there in boats now. I've done that, you know. And what was this Alcatraz takeover, and when did it happen?
The Alcatraz takeover was in 1969.
Approximately. Yeah.
And it was a bunch of Native Americans who banded together under the Indians of All Tribes, and they were citing a treaty, which was, I believe, the Treaty of Fort Laramie, which stated that any surplus federal lands were to be given to Native American tribes. And they used this treaty to claim that since Alcatraz was no longer being used as a prison and it was empty federal land, they could take it and have it for their own. And they planned to turn it into a great center for Native Americans and a university. And it was really impressive to see.
They had
see.
Very practical plans.
Yes.
Because the buildings were intact at that point.
Yes.
And the prison was abandoned. Yeah.
It was amazing to see all the things that they wanted to do with this space. And it's really inspirational to me that, you know, even though we have our tribal differences, we can all band together and make something happen if we need to.
What happened then?
Well, then the government came in and kicked them all off the island. But it they were there for at least a year.
A year.
And
they tried.
They tried. Yeah.
So the government said, essentially, the government abrogated the treaty. They said this treaty is not valid. You can't do this.
Well, you know, they got a history of breaking 375 other treaties.
Yeah.
So it's not new. And what's really amazing about Alcatraz is that, you know, the land was not tillable. The water was not potable. Kind of reminded of many of our people of the different reservations. And yet the government didn't want to give it up, even though they was no longer using it.
Hmm.
So that's another sad chapter.
Now, Ashley, you also mentioned the BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs, I guess, takeover. What happened there? What was being protested, and when did that happen?
I believe they were just protesting just general mistreatment on the part of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And they marched to Washington and took over the Bureau of Indian Affairs building and staged kind of a takeover. And it was another inspiring event. And
when you read about that, you felt this was a fine thing to do because, you know, there was a treatment going on and it was inspiring for you. When did this happen?
That was around the same time.
Around the same time. The 60s were pretty...
Around 72.
72, okay.
Yeah, you know, the takeover was not planned. They were told that when they came to Washington, D.C., that they would have an opportunity to talk to the officials of the Interior, which is where the Bureau of Indian Affairs is.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be talking about the treaty issues and other issues. And then when they got over there, they wouldn't do the talks. And one thing led to another, and they ended up taking over the building.
Mm-hmm. Did anything come of that in terms of...
Well, you know, they came across a lot of papers that showed how twisted the history has been over the last couple hundred years. But it also led to discussions among the different tribes. And many of our tribes are beginning to take over some of their own activities and beginning to get recognized as a government unit by the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a quasi-sovereign nation.
Okay, so in other words, more and more tribes are being officially recognized by the federal government. I believe is it over 300? I think I've read.
About 575.
575 are officially recognized now as entities, tribal entities.
But
by
there
the
are
US
still
government.
Some that are fighting for their recognition.
Mm-hmm. And reservations then are somehow quasi-independent? How does that work? I know the Seneca Reservation in Western New York has its own police. It's a separate entity. I think that state police, if they wish to enter, must ask cooperation because it's considered sovereign territory?
Well, on paper. That's the way it is. And somewhere along the line, the government decided that they had the right to make the decisions for Native American people. And a number of people gave them that right. And it shows up in a lot of issues. But it wasn't until the... probably the Nixon administration, where the idea of addressing the government-to-government relationship with the tribes finally began to take hold.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the longest time, we didn't have that right. I know on the Inhonktown Reservation, the Yankton Sioux Reservation, in the early 80s, they were after a young man who had broken out of the jail, Waddle. And U.S. Marshals would come right onto the reservation, set up block the roads, blockades.
Mm-hmm.
They would go into homes without search warrants, knock holes into the walls looking for Weddle. And they did all of this without search warrants and all that, which if it had happened anyplace else in the United States, there would be a huge cry. And so we still got a long way to go.
Yeah. We're talking with representatives of the Central Ohio Native American Indian community with us in the studio. The occasion for the broadcast, in part, that the annual powwow is going to be this Memorial Day weekend at Franklin County Fairgrounds, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Or is it Saturday, Sunday, Monday?
Saturday, Sunday, Monday,
isn't it? Yeah, and everybody's invited. We'll tell you more about that as we move along here after we take this break at WOSU 820 NPR News.
Senator Jim Webb describes himself as the only person in the history of Virginia to be elected to statewide office with a union card, two purple hearts, and three tattoos. He was Secretary of the Navy in the Reagan administration, is now a Democratic senator, and is one of the people being talked about as a possible vice presidential candidate. He's written a new book. We'll speak with Senator Webb on the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air will be here later this afternoon, beginning at 1 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jarovich. It is 55 degrees at 10:31. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. Don't forget that weekday mornings you can prepare for your day with Morning Edition starting at 5 a.m. Now on WOSU 89.7 FM. Corporate partners help provide support for the programming on WOSU 820. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, active audience every day. Be associated with a trusted local and national brand that the community relies on for accurate news coverage. For more information, contact Christine Shodich at 247-4469. And thanks for supporting WOSU 820. In the weather forecast for today, cloudy skies, a good chance of rain this afternoon, and a high of 63. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low of 45. And now, back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 and PR News. I'm Fred Anderle. We're talking with the representatives of the Central Ohio Native American Indian community. Ashley Hilliard is a student interim coordinator of the Ohio State University American Indian Student Services, and Mark Welch is program director of NACO. That's the acronym for the Native American Indian Center of Central Ohio. We're at 614-292-8513 if you got a comment or a question. And you can email comments and questions to openline at wosu.org. By the way, let me, again, it's the 2008 Memorial Day powwow in honor of Selma Walker, the founder of the Native American Indian Center of Central Ohio. Franklin County Fairgrounds, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And times?
The gates will open at 10 a.m. And the actual dancing will start at 1 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be a lot of activities going on. Also, we'll have over 30 vendors. It'll be a chance to see Native American arts, crafts, foods,
right,
and actually purchase it.
Great food.
Yeah, great food.
I can tell you.
Amazing food.
Amazing food. You're going to have some special guests in. It's Jackie Bird, right? American Indian singer. And
well, unfortunately, Jackie came up with a conflict. Not going to be able to make it. I was looking forward to Jackie coming.
Oh, too bad.
Yeah. But
Peter Chiquito?
Peter Chiquito.
Hoop dancer is coming.
Is a hoop dancer.
What is a hoop dancer? Tell us. I mean, can you? I know we can't see it, but what can you say?
Well, the hoop dancer, they dance with, I guess the best way to describe it is hula hoops.
Okay.
And the better you are, the more hoops you use. And when you watch the hoop dancers, they'll take all those hoops and actually make different forms. For example, Peter does the eagle and the butterfly and quite a few other movements. And when it gets done, he takes all those hoops and forms the world out of it.
Oh, my.
And so you can see that if we all come together, put our minds together, you know, we're one earth.
So it has a spiritual significance.
Very much so.
This is not random by any means.
It's not random.
Yeah.
And even though most people realize that there's a lot of social dancing in the powwow circle, if you think about the circle, everything in that circle is equal,
mm-hmm,
and each step actually has a meaning, then it becomes very, very spiritual. So it's fun and spiritual at the same time.
Sure. We have an interesting email question here from Jim. Jim says, why do we still use the term Indians? It was wrong when Christopher Columbus used it in the 15th century. It's wrong today. Why not abolish the term, says Chris, and just say Native Americans? Now, I know that again, Mark, your center is called the Native American Indian Center of Central Ohio. Ashley, you're at OSU. It's the American Indian Student Services. So tell us about that. It's interesting talk.
Well, you know, this is something that our peoples have discussed over and over and over, and we cannot reach a consensus ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Native American are just like every other people. You get 10 Native Americans together, you got to come with 11 different ideas.
Okay.
And you think about the term Native American. Well, if you're born here in the United States, wouldn't that make you a Native American?
Surely.
Surely. And, of course, the term Indian was given to us by Christopher Columbus. And so, you know, for many, many years, we was known as American Indians. Sometimes that gives us difficulties. I know about 10 years ago, I was speaking in a public school, an elementary school. And I was doing one of our stories. And this young boy and young girl, they're probably fourth graders, came up, and they were very dark-skinned. And they told me that they were Indians, and but they couldn't relate to any of the stories. So I asked them where they were from, and they were from New Delhi.
Okay.
So
we've had that confusion on campus as well with a couple organizations.
Yeah.
There's the Indian American Association, and then there's the American Indian Council. And
sure.
So the interchanging happens quite frequently, but it's amusing when it happens.
So this has been I remember there was a time, I think, when the preferred term was Native American some years ago, and then it moved, switched back to Native American Indian.
And up in Canada, they use First Nations a lot and the First People. I don't know if they'll ever catch on here in the States or not. I kind of like the idea myself. My mother-in-law, when she founded the center, she wanted something that everybody felt comfortable with, so came up with the Native American Indian Center.
And that's where we stand, at least currently, right?
Yeah.
I think it's just personal preferences, and it's up to the person to really decide what they describe themselves as.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I've always kind of thought of it as Native American referring more to the cultural side, and American Indian sometimes referring more to the political side.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I've kind of thought of it sometimes.
Yeah. If I were to say to you, is there a single Native American Indian culture? I mean, there's so many different tribes. Are there commonalities that you could point to? And in what way are they different from the majority culture, if we can say there's a majority culture in America?
Well, you know, there's a two-part story to that. If you look at all the traditional way of life in this country, there's over 375 different cultures of Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
But over the last 150 years or so, our people have discovered a way of coming together, and it's called intertribal dancing. Some of the dancing that you'll see this weekend at the powwow, for example, some of our dances originated out on the Great Plains. Some of the dances originated up in the Great Lakes area, and some of the dances originated here in the East. Now, the Eastern people were great stomp dancers. Their traditional style of dancing. You mentioned the Senecas up in Salamanca, for example. The stomp dance is completely different from the grass dance of the Omaha people. But today, you know, you can go to a powwow, California, and you'll see the Omaha style dancing. You also see the Six Nations style dancing.
Mm-hmm. We want to say that joining us by phone here from Cleveland, Chris Begay is chairman of the Committee for 500 Years of Dignity and Resistance. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hey, hello. How are you guys doing?
Well, what's your day, Chris?
Hey,
welcome.
Good to hear your voice.
Same here.
All right. Chris, thanks for coming on the show with us. Gee, tell us a little bit about the Committee for 500 Years of Dignity and Resistance.
Well, to start off, we're a nonprofit 501c3 organization based in Cleveland, Ohio, and our main focus and objective is the mascot and logo issue that we face here in Cleveland, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just not limited to Cleveland. It's pretty much all over the country, and we just really try to do some outreach and educate people on the issues that come along with names and mascots, and not only that, but Native issues in general. So we try to create awareness and educate people and try to overcome the ignorance. That's pretty much what we try to
do. Tell me about the mascot, the Cleveland Indians. What about that? Give us the whole history of that and why that is offensive to Native American people.
Oh, you want the 101? Okay.
Yeah, here's give me the 101.
Well, the name was actually originated in 1915, and many are under the assumption that it was named after Stock Alexis, but that information is misinformed.
Now, Stock Alexis was who?
Stock Alexis was one of the first Native American – well, he was the first Native to play for a Cleveland team.
Okay.
And there was a Although, if you really look at the mascot, he doesn't resemble Sakalexis, and he's not, the team's not named after them. If for those baseball fans that are out there, they may be familiar with the name the Naps. Cleveland Indians was originally called, prior to being called Cleveland Indians, they were known as the Naps for Napoleon. There was a baseball player that not only played for Cleveland, but it was also a manager, and they named the team after him, so they were known as the Naps for a while, as along with Cleveland Spiders.
So why the Cleveland Indians? Where did that come from?
The Cleveland Indians came about. There was a kind of a the newspaper held a conference a contest for what names could be used for the team, and it wasn't everybody turned in their opinions of what the name should be changed to, and when it came down to it, it was the newspaper that really had the authority in picking the name of the team. So a lot of people are misinformed on that particular history of the Cleveland baseball team.
And it has nothing to do with Sakalexis.
It has nothing to do with Sakalexis, and it isn't related to him whatsoever, but it is an escape story, I believe.
Tell me, Chris, you say it's an escape story. What's that?
If you think about it, at that time, it's right around the time of the Wounded Knee Massacre, Geronimo surrendering. There was a lot of land takeover at the time in the West. And at that time, there was a lot of there was a lot to do with civilization beginning and the time for the Indian dying. There was a lot of that going on at the time. There's a number of collections of photographs from photographers that illustrate exactly what I'm meaning, where they received grant money and were asked to go out to the reservations and stage photographs of civilization beginning and the time of Native Americans were dying. Save the man, kill the Indian.
So they actually staged scenes that showed, quote, civilization being brought to people who were, quote, not civilized. Well, Chief Wahoo is the mascot for the Indians, is that right?
Correct.
I can imagine, just looking at the name, that's got to be offensive.
Yeah, the name's offensive, and, just the caricature. A lot of people don't associate or have little knowledge of, today about Black Sambo and it being eliminated. Not too many people realize that Speedy Gonzalez is no longer around.
That's right.
And yet we have Chief Wahoo and teams like Redskins and Braves. And, there's even still schools out there that are called Savages,
In fact, the Redskin, was a derogatory term in American history, was it not?
Correct. Yeah. It was the selling of men, women, and children's skin and scalps. Yeah. Native people getting ran down and hunted and like animals.
It's interesting.
And now we're being portrayed alongside with animals with mascots. So.
It's interesting that you point out, the Little Black Sambo, the book that I had when I was a kid, and thank God it's gone, an offensive African-American stereotype. That's gone. Other stereotypes are gone. But Ashley Hilliard, what's the reason that these offensive stereotypes persist? I take it that the majority of culture doesn't see them as offensive or doesn't understand that they're offensive.
Well, it's like the media, if you, turn on TV now, all you see is reality TV. Pretty soon people just get, start getting comfortable with the imagery and allow it to be so. Mm-hmm. It's there every day, and pretty soon it just becomes part of their life. And
you don't think about it.
And they don't think about it as much. And, over generations, people start to think of it like people seem to look at it as like lights in Hollywood. You're like a star. Your name's up in lights, and everybody knows about you guys.
And Mark to weigh in on this. Ashley, go ahead.
There's a documentary called In Whose Honor, and it focuses around the struggles that Charlene Teeters went through at the University of Illinois when she was a student there, and she fought tooth and nail to get rid of the Fighting Illini character and the chief Illinoisic mascot that performs at halftimes of...
And does a ludicrous dance, so-called.
They claim that it was supposed to honor Native Americans, and it was based on Native American dancing, and that his costume was authentic.
And but no that, way, huh?
But in the documentary, she recounts a story about how she took her children to see a basketball game and how her children were just ashamed and crying because they saw people laughing and clapping and basically making a mockery of Native American culture. And so this struggle has been going on for years. And I know that in my experience when I was in high school, I can't even count how many different teams we played that were the Redskins or the Indians or any kind of related kind of Native American mascot. And it really upset me. And sometimes I would remark to those people, you know, you realize we're people, not mascots. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely a tricky situation because people become so identified with these mascots. They think of them as describing their lives. And in the documentary, they were showing people who were talking about how the chief was everything to them, and it was their dream to just to meet them, or it was a dream for a kid to be the chief.
These were students, yeah.
These were students and faculty and staff and different alumni from Illinois, and they had been growing up with it for so long that they didn't see how offensive it was.
It's like a blind spot. Huh?
It is. Yeah. When you become so attached to something, you don't realize that it's hurting people.
Mark Welch, you're nodding your head in agreement with all of this. Huh?
Absolutely. And as Kristen actually was saying, you know, it's a denial that Native Americans are human beings. It's still very much racism, although it's funny. And if you look at the Chief Wahoo, and you look at the things from Hitler Germany, when they were degrading the Jewish, you get the idea where the caricature came from. Hmm. And so, you know, it's like we was talking about earlier, you know, they still like to portray Native Americans as savages. Yeah, the earthworks portray that. On May 3rd, they had Newark Earthworks Day over in Newark. And Christine Morris, who's head of the Indian Studies here, and also a great artist.
Head of Indian Studies where? At the
Ohio State University.
Okay, all right.
She and her students, they went to the Octagon Mound, which is the place where Barbara Crandall, a Cherokee descendant.
Yeah, we should talk about this is the Octagon Mound at the Newark Earthworks and a sacred site, which is unfortunately occupied by a golf course.
By a golf course.
Yeah.
And, you know, Barbara was arrested for going there for praying. Well, Christine and the students, they went to make some arts displays for Earthworks Day, and they discovered all these beer bottles and stuff like that left by the golfers at this sacred area.
Christine has an entire collection of things that have been left on the golf course, and I was actually part of the student group that put together the art exhibition, and we were shocked and appalled at how much she really had, and some of the things were things that were thrown at her.
Yeah.
Thrown at her by golfers
for being there. And so it's a very, very rough situation, and it's
here's an area
sad.
You considered sacred because in other words, there are mounds of your ancestors constructed by your ancestors in a very intricate way that has astronomical and implications, religious implications, et cetera. And a golf course occupies the territory. I guess since, what, the 1930s or something?
I think 1911.
1911, yeah. Okay.
But, you know, that art display to me was very powerful and actually showed who the real savages are. So I thought that was powerful. So we're slowly reversing, you know, the images that Chief Wahoo gives and the Kansas City Chiefs gives, you know, and slowly beginning to break that barrier to show that we're human beings too, not mascots.
Chris Begay, now, up in Cleveland, you've made this one of your great purposes in terms of the Committee for 500 Years of Dignity and Resistance. And as you say, the Frito Bandito is gone, Little Black Sambo is gone. But there's this persistence. I mean, we probably talked about this issue on the show for 15 years or so at least. You know, the whole time I've been doing the show, more than 15 years. And it just doesn't seem to go away. Are you able to get much energy around this issue? I mean, among, let's say, Native American Indians in Cleveland, I mean, can you get a lot of people out for demonstrations, or are people kind of saying, well, this is intractable?
We see a lot of schools, a lot of universities taking a stance and getting involved now. Ohio actually has one of the larger numbers of facilities that are named after Native peoples.
Hmm.
And just in Ohio alone, there's over 262 schools that are named Indians, Braves, Redskins, Savages.
No kidding. They're actually named the Savages, really?
Yeah.
These are sports teams, usually.
These are schools.
Schools.
These are educational facilities.
The school is named that.
Their mascot is the Savages, yeah.
Yeah. And the list goes on. You know, it can get tribal. It can get racial. You know, it can be Senecas, Mohawks, Mohicans. It could be Redskins, Savages, you know, Red Man.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a plethora of names that is supposedly representing Native people, but at the same time, there's no education being included in any of this, in any of the process. It's just left up to an image, and there's a lot that goes along with an image, and when you're just left with that bit of information to hold on to, there's a lot that's not being discussed and brought to the table.
Sure.
And as you heard, you know, this is happening all over Indian country, where sacred sites are being territorially taken over, but not only by golf courses, but by corporations as well.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of Native people are really fighting for land and their right to be a sovereign nation. Right now, on the Yankton Sioux Reservation, there's a corporation moving in and trying to place a hog farm in the middle of their gathering area where they hold ceremony. And
this is in South Dakota, yeah.
And have their council meetings and gatherings and whatnot.
It's also right
and yet, a corporation's trying to hastily take over some of their land and put a hog farm right next to where they have ceremony.
Hmm.
So, every time you have ceremony, all you smell is manure.
Well, Chris Begay is chairman of the Committee for 500 Years of Dignity and Resistance in Cleveland. Mark Welch is program director of NACO. That's the acronym for the Native American Indian Center of Central Ohio. Ashley Hilliard is student interim coordinator of the Ohio State University American Indian Student Services. We're at 614-292-8513. You can email a question or comment to openline@wosu.org. We've got a caller on the line from the North End. Hi, caller.
Well, hi. Hey, I just wanted to tell you that I had been at a gathering in April, this past April, and I learned a few interesting facts from some Iroquois and Cherokee people, Chief Warren and some others. But one was that Christopher Columbus, in his manuscripts, he had called the Native Americans Indios. And these Native Americans, they went back to Spain and did a lot of research, and they actually found that his documents were there, and Indios, I-N-D-I-O-S, means God-like. And also, they also found at the same time an Italian manuscript that also backed up this. It was Indiaos, and it meant in with God. And so that the word Indians, you know, that doesn't mean he was trying to find the continent of India, because that's just another history non-truth, so to speak. Because if you know that time, you know, back there was no continent country called India. It was called Hindustan.
Hmm.
That was the first point there.
Hang on, caller. Mark Welch, you're nodding your head in agreement here.
Absolutely. She's got it right on the nail. And, I think that's one of the reasons that my mother-in-law, Selma, liked the term Indian,
mm-hmm.
Because it goes back to and godlike.
Yes.
Why would Christopher Columbus refer to the people he met as godlike?
But the people that he met, the Arawaks and the Caribs, as is true with most of the traditional Native American people, are very connected with their spirituality. and you know, they're in a good relationship with God, good relationship with each other, good relationship with Mother Earth. And when they met Christopher Columbus, you know, instead of seeing a stranger and becoming warlike, they approached him as a relative.
Mm-hmm. And he was impressed by that, apparently.
Very much so.
Were they not? They were not later enslaved, however?
Yeah, he made a comment in his logbook that with 50 people, he could conquer that nation.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Christopher Columbus came to this land not once, but four times. And if you look at the Santa Maria down at the down the river, if you can imagine 500 of our people being taken as slaves onto that ship, taken back to Spain, and realize that only 7 survived the trip.
Uh-huh.
And you know, that ship down there is supposed to be authentic.
I remember that indeed he took Native Americans back to Spain. I did not realize that the death toll was so high.
Yeah, it was very high.
Yeah. Caller, thank you. Got to move on to very quickly. Jeff, hello, Jeff.
Good morning, Fred. I want to ask your guest, as an African-American, I know that the terminology or the label, or I guess the label we use for ourselves, identify ourselves, it has evolved from time to time. And I'd like to ask your panelists, what is the currently accepted or most popular terminology for them? Is it Indians, Native Americans?
Yeah, good question. We had discussed that earlier in the show. You made it
I didn't hear that. I'm sorry.
Just to sum it up, I guess, Ashley, could you give a quick summary to Jeff?
I really believe that it's up to a person to decide what they refer to themselves as, whether it be Native American, American Indian, or whatever. I know I've always kind of associated Native American with myself.
You say Native American.
I say Native American personally.
Mark, you say.
What about First Americans?
I say Mark.
You say Mark. Very good.
What about First Americans? I've heard that term lately.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talked about that as well.
Up in Canada, First Americans, First People, First Nations is used quite a bit. And to me, that makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of hoping that idea eventually catches on here in the States.
Yeah. Chris Begay in Cleveland, do you want to weigh in on this a little bit?
Mainly I just refer to myself as Diné, and that in English would be Navajo, but mm-hmm. most of the time, if I was going to use a term, I wouldn't use a name, but three letters, Indian, N-D-N.
It depends on who you're talking to sometimes.
Similar but different.
Okay. Thanks, Jeff. We're almost out of time, and I want to mention one more time here before we close this coming weekend, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Mark, you're the program director for the Native American Indian Center. It's the Memorial Day Powwow in honor of Selma Walker, the founder of the center. Wonderful person, as we all know. And just give us the details so we know where to go and how to have a good time there.
We're at the Franklin County Fairgrounds. It'll be Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. The gates open at 11. The actual dancing will start at 1. One of the best dancers you can see there is a grass dancer by the name of Chris Begay.
Uh-huh.
We'll dance till about 5 o'clock. We're going to take a dinner break. However, the vendors will still be open. We'll probably have flute players playing during the dinner break. At 7 o'clock, we're going to start again. And when it gets too dark, we're going to go into the building. And we're also going to have there's some walkers going across the country right now from San Francisco to Washington, D.C. They're going to have some representatives at our powwow. So I get an opportunity to see them. And we're going to have an auction on Sunday at noon. And I would say the action this weekend is going to be nonstop.
Franklin County Fairgrounds, locate that for people who don't know where that is.
That's on the west side of Columbus on Interstate 270 in Hilliard, exit 13. Follow the signs to the Franklin County Fairgrounds, okay. And you'll be there.
Well, thank you all for coming. Mark Welch, a program director for the Native American Indian Center of Central Ohio. Mark, good to see you again.
Same here, Fred.
Ashley Hilliard from the Ohio State University American Indian Student Services, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
And from Cleveland, joining us, Chris Begay, chairman of the Committee for 500 Years of Dignity and Resistance. Chris, thanks so much for being part of the show today.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. See you.
And when we come back, medical and health issues with Dr. Robert Guthrie on listener-supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 is NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Meijer. In partnership with the Nature Conservancy, Meijer is helping customers identify and select non-invasive plants for Ohio backyards. Information is available at nature.meijer.com.